You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Look like a little country. Some rock and roll and blues. Cause we sure love playing for good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
You are listening to Savannah Music, Local and Sustainable, the radio show which features conversations with and the music of local musicians and musicians performing in town. I am your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music, Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with Jessica Ann Best. Jessica is a featured performer in the Broadway's Golden Age Concert, scheduled for August 8th, beginning at 8:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah, as part of the 2026 Savannah Voice Festival. The 2026 Savannah Voice Festival is themed Sunny Days and Starry Nights and runs from August 6th through the 16th. Welcome to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Jessica Ann Best.
Thank you, David. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's share with the audience your musical background. Share with us your musical journey.
Oh, well, I was born into a musical family. My grandparents were musicians. They were singers and amateur jazz musicians. And then my mom is a pianist. And so I grew right out of the womb singing and learning instruments. And so I continued that study. I started studying piano with my mom when I was just able to walk and do that on a teeny little keyboard. And I continued to study music in school. I was in a children's choir when I was growing up at the Eastman School of Music. I did musical theater and started taking voice lessons at 12 at the Eastman School of Music. And then I went on to do my Bachelor of Music and Vocal Performance at Nazareth University here in Rochester, New York. And then I did my Master's of Music in Opera and Vocal Performance at Northwestern University, where I met Cheryl. And that was 20 years ago. That was in 2006. So when I began that degree, yes.
Wow. And so you started very young, with the Eastman School of Music.
Yes.
And they had a children's choir?
They had the Eastman Bach Children's Chorus at the time. So I was about 9 years old when I started that. And I was stayed in there until I was 12. And then I went right into voice lessons at their community music school with Renee Fleming's mom. And her name was Patricia Alexander. And she was absolutely a wonderful teacher.
And so what can they do in terms of developing your skills? Because the voice matures.
Absolutely. When you're in your youth in the children's choirs, you're learning how to read music. I knew how to read music because I was reading it since I was at least 3 years old. But you are learning it that way. Often children will learn by rote, so it's a lot of audio learning. So we learned all of our languages because we performed many of Bach's works, many different chamber music pieces, and Handel. So we were singing in German, French, Italian, Spanish, Latin. So we were learning all of that, just language alone, and then our teacher would play our parts out and we would have rehearsals. But you would still learn good breath support, good singing in a collective choral environment. And we were singing with major orchestras, Messiah performances, we made recordings. So it was quite a high level ensemble. And I'm very, very grateful for that. We would tour. And then when you're about 12 years of old, that's a really good time to start your vocal studies. And again, you're learning basic breath support. I did come from an extensive background already at that point, so I was perhaps a little bit more ahead of the game in what music I could process analytically. So I was able to sing more difficult Italian art songs that we often study from the 26 Italian songs. It's a book that we often start singers on. But I was singing Mozart arias. I was singing Carmen, which perhaps at 16 years old isn't the best choice. However, in terms of musical study, I could understand it and handle it. And I would, and handle, of course. And a lot of Broadway and musical theater all throughout and it within that, because that was a part of my, when you're, you know, in musicals and high school and middle school, that's just what you do. That's a norm. So I was part of all of that. And I loved everything. I wanted to color with every color that I could.
Now, you had an advantage because you studied music, and so
Yes.
you could read music before you actually began your choral experience.
Yeah.
And you were surrounded then by music as you developed your skills. As you moved then into the private lessons in your teens, did they start at that point, music theory, or did you wait until you got actually at university to study music theory?
Again, studying piano and music theory was part of the education that I already had in private lessons. And there was musical theory that was available to us in high school. So I had a wonderful teacher teaching that to us as well. But it was already part of my scholarship up to that point. And then you do, as you mentioned, take music theory 1 and 2 in your undergrad, and then upper level advanced music theory, even into graduate studies, because it covers so many things. It's not just building a triad. It's analysis and its form and orchestration and all of that, part writing. So the higher you go, the more extensive it becomes. And I think that, sadly, I think many people would agree with this. As singers, we don't always appreciate those skills until much later, until you're perhaps teaching at a collegiate level or analyzing your operatic scores. And you know, as the mind is able to grow and expand, oh, all of a sudden that makes a lot more sense than when it's in a very condensed setting in your early years.
Now, it's interesting because as a child, you sort of learned everything from your instructor and learned all those languages just to sing that piece.
Yes.
In college, however, as a vocal major, you have a guidebook that guides you to those languages.
Yes. And, you know, I studied French when I was growing up in middle school and high school, and then continued to take that because I knew at an early age that I wanted to sing in the classical realm. And for me, it was very good because I was a mezzo and there's a lot of French repertoire that's really good for me. And then I started studying Italian in college. And then we took French diction and Italian diction and German diction, English diction, both in undergraduate and our graduate studies, and in every young artist program that you work on, and you still continue to work. And that expands into the Slavic languages, into Spanish. And of course, now we all have this amazing app like Duolingo that we can learn from, which I'm not getting paid to say, but, you know, which I do every day because I like to keep up my skills and try different languages as well. So, yeah, it's an extremely important thing to know what you are singing and to have the grammatical background to understand why you're singing in this verb, in this tense, in that moment.
And as you go through undergraduate school and graduate school, just about everywhere, you get a lot of experience singing, both in terms of art song as well as opera.
That's right. Yes, you have, and you're learning the gamut. You are learning things that are written today that are very new art songs. And I think that's important for people to know that there are new pieces being written today in both the operatic and the art song repertoire, just as there are popular song. In fact, that's something that Savannah does very well because we have composers like Michael Ching and Jody Goebel that bring this wonderful, extensive repertoire to us in both art song and opera pieces, which I've had a wonderful ability to premiere some of those new works like Alice Riley, which is, of course, a wonderful Savannah tale. So, yes, we get to learn all of the most important repertoire that is available to us, from Pacini to Gershwin to Fauré, you know, Mozart, the leader, the Schumanns. There's an extensive world culture study that we get to have as musicians. And I think that that also makes us better humans because we really have an understanding of history and the range of poetry and things that were important to humankind throughout the ages.
And interesting enough, just a while back, I was talking to Karim Suleiman, the tenor, who's also a graduate of Eastman. And we were talking about the incorporation of new music into the language of the student there at Eastman, because Eastman is really known for, at least in the instrumental side, is really known for its incorporation of new music into the arts of music. And he was saying that he was exposed to that quite early, actually, as an undergraduate.
Yes, exactly. So it's extraordinarily important. And if, in fact, I'll mention them. Next week, I'm going to the National Association of Teachers in Singing Conference, which is called NATS, which takes place in San Antonio. And we are, my colleagues and I are premiering an entire new set of art songs that will be available for students to study and performers alike that is based on a place here in New York called Oswego, where there were actually refugees from World War II. And my dear colleague and friend, Dr. Katie Hannigan of Nazareth University, curated these works with composers and librettists that are known today. So this is a living work. And I'm premiering two of those pieces. So we're showing, you know, that even right now, we're writing tremendous works and bringing it scholarship and availability to new students. So one of the pieces I'm singing is actually called An American Girl. And it's about an 11-year-old immigrant that comes to this country and wants to be an American. And it's really incredible. It's a jazz and operatic tune. It's a wonderful piece of work. Michael Rice is the composer. So you have this availability, and now all of these students from universities will be able to buy this songbook and their teachers and be able to learn something new like that.
And so you just mentioned that it's a sort of a jazz and classical mix. Now, at what point do you start incorporating more popular music into your repertoire as a student?
That's probably up to the teacher. I think, and I hope, that in our school systems that those are partnered early, because it's accessibility for the students, and that's what really makes our American music so wonderful. That we have this generous repertoire of Rodgers and Hammerstein and Irving Berlin and Gershwin available to us with really beautiful melodies that are great for singing legato, that are great stories. And as a teacher myself, that's where I often start with my students. I'll partner some of the Golden Age Broadway music with their art songs so that they understand. You know this language already. You know this story of the human heart, the human condition. Let's now cross over into the 15th or 16th century and see how this composer said it. But you see, the person in here is very similar to our of Rodgers and Hammerstein. So, but I've also appreciated and have adapted to that style early, and it was in my ear. So I think that, especially as an American teacher, I think that that's a really important responsibility for us to hold our compositions high and partner them with global compositions.
So these programs that you do as part of the Savannah Voice Festival are collaborative. Sounds like they're very collaborative between you, perhaps other singers who are going to be involved in that particular program, and these directors of the program, of the directors of the particular performance.
Yeah.
And so, upcoming festival, you'll be singing as a featured performer in the concert entitled Broadway's Golden Age. And I thought it was very interesting because they're defining Broadway's Golden Age from 1943 to 1960, which actually is the period of Rodgers and Hammerstein working together. From Oklahoma in 1943...
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye. And it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way. The cattle are standing like statues. All the cattle are standing like statues. They don't turn their heads as they see me ride by. But a little brown maverick is winking her eye. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful. Got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
Aunt Taylor.
Nah, scared me to death. What you doing around here?
Well, I come a-singing to you.
All the sounds of the earth are like music. All the sounds of the earth are like music. The breeze is so busy, it don't miss a tree. And an old weeping willow is laughing at me. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling.
To Sound of Music in 1960.
Sing on.
What sort of songs are you going to be singing?
Well, I can't give away what songs that I'm singing, so you'll have to be there. But you can know that it will be from that repertoire. And our wonderful music director, Justin Havard, and I were connecting about this yesterday about some really fun possibilities. But we know that, I love a Judy Garland song. So I've done a lot of the Great American Songbook. So you can expect to hear some, like I said, some Gershwin and Irving Berlin and Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lerner and Lowe, things from this repertoire that I always say a little bit of the Blonde Bombshell pieces, perhaps some Marilyn or Peggy Lee pieces and things like that. But torch songs and some really exciting pieces of American musical theater. And you can expect to hear your favorites from all of those wonderful shows. Like, I'm sure there will be a South Pacific or Cinderella, Sound of Music, perhaps A Star is Born. I'm really hoping for that.
The folks keep coming back to festival after festival after festival because it seems to be like a family.
That's right. Yes, it is very collaborative. And I believe that Maria is also directing this particular production as our stage director. So that's going to be really wonderful. And as you said, quite a family experience because we all have a long-standing working relationship with each other. And I believe singing as well. So we will say, it's a wonderful creative meeting of minds to say, what do you bring to the table? What have you got in your pocket? What have you been doing? And perhaps there is something that is already just brewing under the surface. Someone really feels, oh, we must do several selections from this because we feel that that's an important perhaps theme to explore or something that we really want to say. And I think many creatives really listen and allow for that. It seems that there's a commonality here. What is the theme that really wants to bring itself forward and that really works for everybody? And it's always like coming home, it's always the repertoire just really will find itself into this beautiful explosion of harmonies, and the people that usually do the Broadway concert are always really fabulous actors as well. So it's a wonderful culmination, and I know that the audience will be on its feet.
So tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I've been talking with Jessica Ann Best. And as we've been talking about, Jessica is the featured performer of Broadway's Golden Age Concert, which is scheduled for August 8th, beginning at 6:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Universal Church of Savannah, and as part of the 2026 Savannah Voice Festival. The 2026 Savannah Voice Festival is themed Sunny Days and Starry Nights and runs from August 6th through the 16th. And I want to thank you so much, Jessica, for being on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
What does it mean when we say that WRUU is a community radio station? It doesn't just mean that we invite the community to create programming. And it doesn't just mean that we are a voice for the community. It also means that we are counting on the community to keep us going. And you are the community. Almost all of our modest budget comes from small annual or monthly donations from listeners like you. You get to enjoy our community-focused programming because many others have stepped forward to do their part. Now do your part by joining our community of listener donors. Go to WRUU.org right now and make a one-time or monthly donation. And thank you for supporting Savannah's community radio station, 107.5 FM.
This portion of WRUU's programming is brought to you by listeners like you and by the 2026 Savannah Voice Festival. Season 14 of the Savannah Voice Festival is themed Sunny Days and Starry Nights and includes opera, art song, musical theater, and popular song. It is Everything Voice from August 7th to the 16th at several locations around Savannah. More information and tickets can be found at www.savannahvoicefestival.org. The historic Savannah Foundation is offering a six-week series of line dance workshops as part of the Summer Fall Artisan Spotlight Series on Tuesdays, at 5:30 to 7 p.m. from July 14th to August 18th at the Davenport House Preservation Center, 323 East Broughton Street, Savannah. Join for the full series or drop in for a fun 90-minute session. More information and tickets are available at www.myhsf.org. This music is often called classical music, but remember, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt were the rock stars of their time, so I simply call it great music. I'm your host, Dave Lake, and join me for four centuries of great music, with new episodes each week on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. We also have encores of these episodes on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. from mid-June to early December. Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I have soprano Melanie Spector, who will be starring in the August 15th performance of The Magic Flute on Saturday, August 15th at 6:30 p.m. at the Ashbury Memorial Church, which is at 1008 East Henry Street, and parking is in the rear. Welcome to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Melanie Spector.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about Melanie Spector. Tell me your musical journey.
Well, I come from a musical family. My mother, Susan Spector, was second oboe in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra for 31 seasons. And my dad, Gary Spector, has been a huge fan of opera and has been going to the Met for over 50 years. And they never forced opera on me. I just ended up being very curious. My origin story, so to speak, is that my dad had a broadcast of Wagner's Siegfried on in his home office on the radio. And the forging scene where Siegfried is making a sword, I was hearing that music and I asked him, what's going on? Because there's a lot of banging sounds and against metal. And he said, well, there's this hero, Siegfried, who's forging a magic sword to go kill a dragon, who's sitting on top of a pile of gold and a magic ring. And I said, that sounds really cool. Is there a video of that? And sure enough, we watched all of Siegfried together, which turned into watching the entire Ring cycle from the Met production in the 90s. And the very next season, I was 6 years old, and I begged my parents, please, I want to go see the Ring cycle live at the Met. And they said, this is crazy, but okay. And so my mom played in those performances in the pit, and my dad took me to all four of the operas and all, what, 16 hours worth, and I was immediately hooked. So that's kind of how things got started. 2 years later, I ended up joining the Met's children's chorus, and so I got to appear on stage several times in multiple operas, singing in multiple languages, and getting to sing on the stage of the Met and alongside all of these huge stars like Jonas Kaufmann and Elena Garancha only helped and motivated me to continue pursuing a career in singing and going on to study privately and go to Manhattan School of Music for bachelor's and master's in vocal performance. And now I'm here.
Well, unique may be going too far, but I want to say, starting your interest in opera at such a young age with Wagner has to be unique.
I would say so. I think most people, when I tell them that story, seem pretty intimidated, and they thought, wow. Because normally when people are asked, oh, what's a good first opera to take a novice to, usually the answer is something like La Boheme or Carmen. And those are great too, but somehow the combination of the mythological elements of the story, and also I was immediately attracted to the richness of the orchestra, and because all four of the operas have close to 100 players, at least 90, and huge brass sections, which later also inspired me to study French horn for a long time. I haven't played in a while, sitting in my closet, but it all of that together immediately piqued my interest, and I thought, this is amazing that all these elements can be combined into one staged thing with costumes and lighting and all of that. It immediately piqued my interest.
So at such a young age, going to the opera with things happening very quickly, yes, there are superscript titles, but I can only imagine you were caught up with the excitement of the music and the spectacle.
Yes, I definitely was. However, my dad loves to tell this story that I guess I had been watching the telecast from the Met so carefully when we watched it on DVD at home before going to the Ring Cycle, and I was paying attention to the words and the subtitles, that when we went to the Met and saw the performance live there, I believe it was Die Walküre, I told him at the end of, I want to say, Act Two, I said, "Daddy, the words are wrong." He said, "What do you mean the words are wrong? What are you talking about?" It turns out the Met had used slightly different subtitles for their live performances of the Ring Cycle versus the ones that they used on the telecast in the 90s. And so I guess I'd been paying close enough attention. I don't remember what difference there was, but he said, "This is crazy that she's catching on this close." But overall, yes, the spectacle immediately, that's really what piqued my interest. And being in the forest of Act Two of Siegfried and feeling it was so magical, and the production by Otto Schenk, which is still my all-time favorite production of The Ring I've ever seen, which I've now seen multiple cycles. Wagner is still probably my favorite opera composer, even though I don't sing a lot of his music yet, fingers crossed. But the production immediately drew me in, and I loved it, and I still love it to this day. So,
for both male and female singers, Wagner is probably one of the last things you try to accomplish, because it is very hard on
Absolutely.
The vocal structures.
It is, and the voice takes a long time to develop. I mean, most people say the voice, the operatic voice, doesn't fully develop until someone is in their mid-30s. So I still have a ways to go. You know, I can do with what I have right now, but it's something that comes from within. It's based on body shape, bone structure, hormone changes, aging. There's so much that goes into it. I did have one chance to sing Wagner, which was amazing. I had an opportunity fall into my lap to be a part of the Miami Music Festival's Wagner Institute, which I believe is no longer in existence, but I was glad to be a part of it when it was there. And I was Voglinda, the highest Rhine maiden in Das Rheingold. And we did it with, I don't think it was full orchestra, but it was a huge orchestra. And we had an immersive production. And to get to sing Wagner's music after having fallen in love with it and taking me on this huge journey was amazing. Getting to be the first voice heard in the entire Ring Cycle, because Voglinda's the first to enter after you hear 6 minutes of sweeping E flat major and coming in was so amazing. And I hope one day I'll be able to sing more Wagner, and if singing Voglinda again, I would love to in a heartbeat. If eventually, my unrealistic dream role would be Brunhilde, but at the moment I don't quite have the pipes for that, but you just never know where the voice is going to take you. So I'll continue hoping.
Well, I have to admit that probably the first music from opera that I listened to was Wagner, because of the orchestral adaptations of
Siegfried's Journey, for instance, or music from Tristan and Isolde. So the first music from an opera that I listened to was undoubtedly Wagner.
And it brings you in, right? You're just immediately, it's like it surrounds you. It's like it's giving you a big hug or something. That's what I felt. And in combination with the theatrics and just feeling like I was right there in the forest with Siegfried surrounded by these trees and hearing the Wagner just knew how to write so well. For instance, you know, the way he writes the music for the Rainbow Bridge in Das Rheingold, I couldn't imagine a rainbow sounding anything different. That's just how a rainbow would sound, or the bird calls in the forest in Siegfried, or he just had a way somehow of just capturing, you know, I've never thought of how a rainbow sounded, but that's how it would sound. Yeah.
Well, not counting your debut at the Metropolitan Opera as part of the children's chorus and the various roles that you sang there, what was the first opera you sang as an adult?
My first full role in a fully staged opera was Miss Wordsworth in Britten's Albert Herring. It was really fun. Britten is another composer I adore. He writes in such a clever way. And Miss Wordsworth is the school teacher. Albert Herring is this really funny story taking place in a British town in the early 1900s that all the townspeople have their own personalities. And Albert Herring is a young boy discovering who he is, discovering the world. And he's nominated as the May King, which is this hoity-toity celebration on May Day in the town where, you know, there are all these rituals and rules that have to be followed, and Albert really doesn't want any part of this. And long story short, he ends up, because of a couple of teenagers in the town, he accidentally gets drunk off of the lemonade that's served, the spiked lemonade, he doesn't know it's spiked, at the festival. And, of course, as the school teacher, I was there admonishing him, you know, while also taking care of my students and all that. So it's a funny story, but it was amazing to be able to, for the first time, sing with an orchestra and have everything combined. Being in a costume that was, you know, relatively heavy and navigating that on stage, making sure I didn't trip, making sure I could see the conductor either in person or on a monitor, navigating the really complicated music, navigating being aware of my other colleagues on stage. There are just a million things going on when you sing an operatic role. It's not just about the voice. It's not just about the acting. There's so many things going on and your brain is so busy. So to get to have that as my first opportunity was very challenging, but it taught me a lot, and it's gotten easier since then with experience. But it was a fun first run of doing an operatic role, and it was great doing it at Manhattan School of Music as well, and feeling like I was in a safe and encouraging space to explore all of this for the first time.
So Albert Herring by Benjamin Britten, not mm-hmm. one of your more common operas. And I think that's one of the joys of university experience, is that they'll, yes, occasionally do La Boheme, which is every season for the last 15 seasons at the Metropolitan Opera, the same production. But it allows you to explore other music besides the classics, as well as probably the classics.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great opportunity. And MSM... MSM for a long time has made a point of doing operas, including operas in their season, that are not done as often, which I think is good in a way that lots of people, audience members, when they attend La Boheme, especially opera goers who have been going for years and years and years, when they hear a Mimi, most of the time they already have a Mimi in their ear who they love and a soprano whose interpretation they think is immaculate. And when you have a student singing Mimi for the first time, it's hard to differentiate that, you know, oh, this person is still growing vocally and this is ultimately a student production, and to put any pre-performance opinions, you know, in the back of your mind. So it's good that I love that MSM does these operas that aren't done as frequently, because people aren't coming in with voices already in their heads. They're ready to accept something completely different that they don't quite know as much about. So that's really cool. I was going to say also, the same year I did Albert Herring, my second role, full operatic role, was with Savannah Voice Festival, my first time there doing Sister Constance in Poulenc's Dialogues of the Carmelites, which is done more often, I'd say, than Albert Herring, but it's not your everyday. It maybe pops up maybe every 5, 6, 7 years, for instance, the Met season. But Savannah was also very helpful in helping me navigate doing a full role for one of my first full roles. And it was a really beautiful experience. And we all still talk about it, even though it was back in 2019, as being one of the most special productions that Savannah has ever produced.
Well, the fact that you were introduced to opera via Wagner, and everybody says then, oh, that can't be the first thing that you would recommend people listening to. And you mentioned some. The one you didn't mention is The Magic Flute, which would be my number one opera for a young person, or a young person of any age, young to opera, to listen to, because it's an interesting combination of fantasy. It is wonderful singing. It's Mozart, after all. And it's done in a Singspiel approach, so that you're not overwhelmed by every minute being sung. But it is an interesting combination of magic and down-to-earth singing.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, I also believe that The Magic Flute is an excellent first opera for whether you're already an adult and haven't been to the opera yet, or you have young kids. And I do love that places like the Met also do an abridged version of The Magic Flute if seeing the entire version feels too daunting. I mean, not to toot my own horn, but I think, but after having seen The Ring Cycle, I was already ready to see the full version in German dialogue, no problem, but not everybody is like that, and that's fine. But you can't help but smile when you hear the first 3 chords of the orchestra and know that you're about to be taken on a very magical journey. And there are so many amazing characters, having the juxtaposition of the day and night, the sun, the moon, and Zarastro and the Queen of the Night, and everyone in between. And it's delightful. I love it. I never get tired of it. I can always come back to it and end up finding something new that I can appreciate or love about it.
Well, let's talk about Die Zauberflöte, the magic flute. And what's the story of this?
It's essentially, there are 2 lovers in the story. You have Tamino, who is a prince of a foreign land. We don't know exactly where. It's very mysterious. And you have Pamina, who is a princess and the daughter of the Queen of the Night. And Pamina, before the opera has begun, has been abducted by the Sun King, Zarastro, who rules the land, and at least according to the Queen of the Night, has taken away her power, as she was once ruler of the kingdom. And essentially, Tamino, thanks to the Queen of the Night's 3 ladies, or her attendants, they bring him a picture of Pamina and say, hey, the Queen of the Night wants you to go rescue her from Zarastro, and if you can, then you can marry her. And he's like, wow, that sounds great. And so, with the help of a magic flute and Papageno, who is a bird catcher and who works for the Queen of the Night. They become pals on this journey together. They go through various trials in trying to get into Zarastro's kingdom to find Pamina and rescue her. And in that journey, they realize that while, yes, Tamino wants to be united with Pamina, they realize that the Queen of the Night's intent in sending them there was not necessarily the greatest, and that part of her goal was to destroy Zarastro's kingdom because, in her words, he's evil and all that. And so, long story short, the knight is banished, as Zarastro says at the very end, and the sun rules. And Tamino not only rescues Pamina and marries her, but the knight, or evil, is banished for good. And so, spoiler alert, unfortunately, I die, and the Queen of the Night and her minions, the three ladies, and also Monostatos, who is another character who turns out to be evil, we're all banished somewhere. So, yeah, it ends happily for everybody else except for me. So, boo.
Well, and you sing two arias. One is very passionate, and one is very, I want to almost say, violent.
Yes, absolutely. They're both very different. The first act aria, O zittre nicht, or O tremble not, my lieber Sohn, my dear son, as she refers to Tamino, is very lyric. And in fact, the first half of the aria is basically a recitative followed by this very legato section that sits pretty low for a coloratura soprano. It sits right in the middle of the voice, or what we call the passaggio, which is kind of a complicated area of the voice where it's like, do I add more chest voice or head voice, etc.? But that's getting really technical. But it's very lyric, because when people think of the Queen of the Night, they immediately think of the high Fs. So this is a very different register for that type of soprano. And it's her passionately telling Tamino about how Pamina was abducted and how she felt her strength, the queen's strength, just vanish, and that she couldn't do anything. And I want to say in that moment that, yes, okay, the queen has some evil intentions, but at the end of the day, she's a mom and she lost her daughter, and she's genuinely destroyed and sad. And so, yes, part of it is a show like, oh, let me bring Tamino in and make him feel really sad over this story so he'll go, you know, do my bidding. Yes, there's that manipulation, but she also has lost her daughter. So anyway, the first aria is much more of a storytelling, and of course it ends the second half with this flourish and the first high F out of five.
Thank you.
It's and it almost feels like a combination, like a bel canto aria in a way, where you start with a slow lyrical section and then have a cabaletta at the end. That's sort of what it feels like. The second aria, Der Hölle Rache, or the famous one that you hear on commercials and that everyone knows, that is, it's essentially a 3-minute scream fest. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like screaming, but it's in a moment in the opera where she discovers that Pamina has fallen in love with Tamino, and then she realizes that Pamina has drunk the Kool-Aid, so to speak, and thinks that Sarastro is the good guy now. And the queen doesn't like that and threatens Pamina and gives her a knife and says, okay, well, Tamino's lost. He's a lost cause. He's not going to do this. So I need you to take this knife and go kill Sarastro so I don't lose my power and we don't lose this. And so it's 3 minutes of, as you said, very violent singing. She's very angry, and the motivation is very strong, and the high Fs come from a place of she can't even get it into words. It's almost like it's musical screaming, really, that she's so angry. She has to let it out, even if it's non-verbal. It's interesting that the arias are so different, and it's interesting being able to navigate that. But what is nice is that for the queen, you get a long break in between O Zitronicht and Der Hölle Rache, which is in Act Two. So you have time to settle, take some water, sit down, you know, scroll Instagram maybe, and then come back. Because it would be a little hard. I have in some auditions for Queen, I've had to sing both arias back to back, and oh my God, it's really challenging, but obviously it's not realistic in terms of singing it within the context of the opera. But yeah, it's an incredible role, and it's amazing. It's so short, but there's so much in it.
Thank you.
Well, and of course, you're performing with some wonderful people. Zastro is Benjamin Sokol. Tamino is Eric Shebeck.
I can't wait to work with my other colleagues, Eric, Ben, and Benji, and Emma Peterson as well.
Well, and Papageno is actually being sung by a first-time member of the studio, and that's Evan Stark. So tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I've had Melanie Spector, who is a soprano and who will be starring in the production of The Magic Flute, and that is on Saturday, August 15th at 6:30 p.m. at the Ashbury Memorial Church, again, which is at 1008 East Henry Street with parking in the back, so you don't have to worry about street parking. And I want to thank you so very much, Melanie, for being on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
This has been another edition of Music Local and Sustainable, and I've been your host, Dave Link. Save this time for another show next week.
Well, I know we ain't headed for the Hall of Fame. Gonna give it what we got, man, that ain't no shame. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.